All right, we are beginning our first lesson on the desirable characteristics class. This is the first lesson out of Proverbs 24. And I've already been criticized once about this. My wife says she doesn't like those because they're not big enough. Not enough room for notes from each of those squares. So I'll invite you to do what I told her to do and get these notebook papers. I could have put all 24 of those points on a single page, but there wouldn't have been room for any notes. And I didn't want to put one for each page because that's a waste. And I thought maybe that size would be helpful if you wanted to jot a few things down. But I certainly would encourage you to, in your study, take copious notes and make many applications and ask many questions and then have those available to share with the class. And that would be something that will help our study. I'd like to remind you of what we talked about as we ended our class last Sunday in the introduction, and that our study is intended to, first of all, identify some of the desired characteristics, things that God would have us to incorporate into our character. He would like us to be like these individuals that will be identified in the various lessons. So these are basically character studies, somewhat limited to a specific aspect of character. In fact, we're going to be talking about the mind of Christ. And as you look at the two passages, there are two things that are emphasized. One is his humility that we're going to discuss, and also his complete willingness to submit himself to the will of his Father. And those are certainly things about Christ and his thinking, his approach, if you will, as he lived on this earth, that are, I think, very worthy of emulation on our part. We could, when we say have the mind of Christ, but be like Christ, we could go on and on and on and on about various things. But these are the two passages that were chosen, and we'll talk a little bit about those. So we're going to limit ourselves, not just have a broad character study, but some aspect of these individuals' character that are mentioned. I'd like you to keep that in mind. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't put it on. Now it is. Okay. And with regard to that, the three points that we had at the end of our time together is identify the characteristics, discuss those characteristics themselves. In other words, if we say that we're to have humility, then what is humility as it is defined by the Bible? We may look at some other passages to help to define and flesh out that characteristic. And then the third thing is to discuss some practical ways that we can both attain the characteristics as well as we can apply the characteristics or demonstrate the characteristics in our life. So it's basically a threefold study. And I would encourage you again, before each lesson, to read the passages with the topic in mind. In other words, the specific characteristic. And take some notes concerning that, how it's defined, as well as the application, some questions that you might have, so that those can be brought up as a matter of course in our discussion. And the only other thing that I would add is that some of the passages that we'll be looking at might have some concept or some language that is confusing to you or somewhat difficult. And if that is the case, when you have a question about the text themselves, as we go over those, then if you will, share those questions or comments with the class, and we'll try and get to the bottom of any potential difficulties that might be found in the text themselves. But primarily, it is a character study. And again, as we begin our time on the first lesson, the first passage that we want to make note of, is Philippians, the second chapter. Philippians chapter 2. And starting off with verse 5 and going through verse 8 of the text, and remind you before we actually get into the reading that there is an admonition that the Apostle Paul is giving to the church at Philippi concerning the need for humility and unity of mind. Those are the two things that are being, I think, emphasized in verses 1 through 4. He wants them in verse 2 to be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. and indicates that the way that can be accomplished is through selflessness or humble attitude or spirit. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. And then in verse 4, let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also the interest of others. And then he uses Jesus as the example to demonstrate the type of selflessness and humility attitude that he wanted the Philippians to have. So verses 5, actually it goes down through verse 11, but in actuality the point of the humility, the mind of Christ, is in 5 through 8. So would someone read that for me, please? Philippians 2, verses 5 through 8. Armando, if you would, please.
Have this attitude yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross.
Okay. All right, so in looking at the text, I actually had reason in sermon on Sunday to talk a little bit about humility, and told you about that quote that I came across on the internet concerning what humility is, and the point that we talk about the various attributes that we are to add to our faith, add to our faith virtue, knowledge, to knowledge, temperance. Those are things that we are to add to our character. But that humility, properly defined, is something a bit different. And the way it was expressed in this particular... I think it was a little blurb that I read, one of those signs that you see on Facebook. But it was that humility is what is left when you take something away. And what you take away is self, ego. Self-will, selfishness, and when that's taken away, crucifying self. When self is taken out of the picture, then what is left is an individual who is humble. He is selfless. He's not thinking about himself. And as you look at the call in verse 4, let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. That if you're concerned with what the other person thinks, if you want to be like them, you want to express the same love for them, be like-minded, to be concerned and interested in what they desire, what they need, then that is an indication of humility. It's getting outside of self, thinking of others rather than thinking of self. And Jesus is a wonderful example of this. Jesus was selfless. And this is demonstrated in what he did. Of course, what he did was making himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant. He came in the likeness of men, and he died on the cross. So he humbled himself. He didn't do it for himself. He did it for you and I. So that was outside of self, and this was something he willingly did. So selflessness is the key, I think. In fact, in the next lesson that we're going to be talking about is the humility of Solomon. So I would like to emphasize the cause of Christ's humility, the fact that he said in verse 8, that being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient. So the humbling of self, that's a little bit different than the quality or characteristic of humility. I think that it is an outgrowth of it. But the willingness to humble himself is that willingness to make low himself, to suffer the indignities of the cross, to lower himself to the point to where he lived among us as a man. This was something that was far different from the exalted place that he had as he was at the right hand of the Father. But it was something he willingly did because of his selfless attitude. He wasn't concerned about his position, his place, how he was being perceived. He was only concerned about saving men. And so whatever was needed for that to be accomplished, he was willing to do. And of course, we'll tie in with the next text in Matthew chapter 26 in just a few moments as well. Okay? Yes, sir.
When you look at this comment about no reputation, when you look at Christ when he was healing people, quite often he would say, don't go out and tell anyone. He didn't want people to rush him just to heal him. Like you said, he was there to save souls. That was not his purpose, to come on earth as a healer.
Okay, good. Yeah, and everything needed to be in accord with his will, his timeline, his purpose. And he very definitely arranged things to make sure that what he desired to accomplish was accomplished. And that was, of course, the primary purpose. With regard to this, the one thing I wanted to keep in mind in establishing that he accomplished these things and serves as an example for us is that the passage itself is one that is, I wouldn't say necessarily difficult. The language is somewhat challenging. So there are a couple of points that I want to make so that everyone is familiar with what it was that Jesus actually did. So first of all, with regard to that statement, that he did not consider it robbery or something to be grasped. The word robbery is the one that is used in, I believe, the King James as well as the New King James Version. He did not consider it robbery to be equal with God. And that's a very, very difficult and kind of a, I guess, archaic or there's a word that's not coming to my mind, not clumsy, but it was a challenging way of putting it. And what Armando read, which was from the, I'm assuming, the English standard?
New American
Standard Version, is what is intended by this and much easier term to understand. So he had a position that was at the right hand of the Father in heaven. And it was something that if we were to have such a position and a place, it would be something that we would hold on to or desire to hold on to. If we were there, it may be that we would wrap both arms around as tight as we can because it was such a privilege and such a position of honor and glory to be there. So it was something that was very valuable, very important, that he willingly gave up. And so it wasn't a situation where this will of God that man be saved, redeemed, Jesus says, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. In the fullness of time, I don't want to leave my place. I desire this too much. It was something he willingly did. He desired to do. And of course, we recognize that while he was on earth, he desired to do the will of his Father always. Now in the garden, as he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, we acknowledge the fact that it was a very difficult thing to do that. But he even said at that point in time, when the weight of that obligation and burden was greatest, not my will, but thine be done. So that's the concept that is found here in that idea. Nothing, he did not consider it robbery, nothing to be grasped or held on to. It was a great place, a great position, but something that he willingly, enthusiastically gave up because of his concern for mankind. And so what does it mean that he gave it up? Well, there are a lot of views with regard to this. Some confusion with regard to the statement, he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant. What does that mean? Well, when he comes in the form of a bondservant, comes in the form of man, comes in the likeness of man, the word that is used in this particular text, the first word of the two, is the Greek word morphe, M-O-R-P-H-E. It's the one that we get morph from. Something changes from one thing to another. The mighty morphing Power Rangers is the one that comes to my mind whenever I see that. It's a child show that my kids, when they were young, loved that show. So I got it ingrained into my head that they would change from one thing to another, change to the Power Rangers at some point in time. But the key about morphing and the key from the Greek word morphe that's important is when it says he comes in the form of God, or form of man, excuse me, that does not indicate that he was only appearing to be a man but really wasn't. The word morphe or form indicates that he was in actuality a man. So, Jesus The reference is to Jesus being both in the form of man as well as the form of God. So what this emphasizes is his dual nature. That when he was on earth, he was God, Emmanuel, God with us, God in the flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. But he was also really a man. Now, the reason why it's important to point this out is because in the first century, there were a group of people, that Gnostic heresy that had its beginning and is referred to in 2 Peter as well as John's epistles and Jude, those individuals were claiming that Jesus wasn't really a man. You'll remember the specific characteristic of Gnostic teaching was that the flesh is inherently evil. So if they believe that the flesh is inherently evil, Jesus could not really have been in the flesh. He could not really have been a man. He could only appear to be a man. So they would take that concept of the form and indicate that that's not really, he wasn't really a man. But he was. He was a man just as you and I are men. Having said that, and of course from that we affirm that he was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. As such, he is legitimately a mediator or go-between between both God and man, because he is both God and man. But also, there have been some individuals in our time, some who claim to be Christians, claim to be gospel preachers, who have taken the position that Jesus, while he was on earth, was not God. There's a statement that one made, and he recanted it, although he still argues the same position. He recanted the position, the statement he made, because it was so damaging. But he said, when Jesus was on earth, he was just a man, just like you and me. Now, it's all right to say, when Jesus was on earth, he was a man, just like you and me. But he said, he was just a man, just like you and me. In other words, that when he came to this earth and took on the form of man, that this making himself of no reputation indicates that he divested himself of his deity. Those divine attributes he no longer had them while he existed on earth. He was only a man. And we understand that that likewise is a false position. So the duality of Jesus we want to affirm, and it is thought in this particular text, that Jesus, while he was on earth, he was a man, but while he was on earth, he was also God in the flesh. What it's talking about when it says that he made himself of no reputation is he left that position. He left that exalted place in heaven and came to earth. And I want you to notice the second term that is used in the text, where we are told that in verse 8, that being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Well, the word appearance in that particular passage, or that part, is from the word schema. And so it's referring to the fashion, or signifies what he was in the eyes of men. So there is an outward demonstration. So men perceived him to be a man. And of course, because they did not accept him as God, lawless hands crucified him on the cross of Calvary. And yet he was not merely a man. His appearance was as a man. He was truly a man, but he also remained God. So when we talk about him being divested of that privilege at the right hand of the Father, it simply has a reference to the fact that he left heaven and he took on a human form, and he was humiliated or humbled even to the point of death as he died on the cross of Calvary. And the key, of course, is he did it because of his love for man, because he was not concerned about self, but rather he was selfless and directed his actions for the welfare and benefit of others. And that's what we should seek to emulate. Okay? All right, so questions, comments, additional points? Yes?
Point out that all of these things were done willingly by himself. He made himself of no reputation. He humbled himself. And he became, all these he did on purpose too, himself or us.
Yeah, in fact, that's something we want to emphasize when we get into the next text in Matthew 26. Because it was the will of the Father. It was the determination of the Father that he do these things. But this was him making the decision to be obedient to his Father's will. And again, something certainly worthy of our emulation in that regard. Anybody else? Yes?
The act of being humble or imitating Christ is a very small price tag to pay back to Christ to show him that we truly are appreciative.
Very good. That's a very good point. Very good point. Dick?
Yeah, first of all, on that term of robbery, that was a common term that you hear like in the 20s and 30s and 40s, probably into the 50s, like that. But then about, you mentioned about that when Christ came, he did not exalt himself and make all that. And he did that because he first loved us when we was yet sinners. And at the fulfillment of the time. And of course, God knew this. He knew that before the foundation of the world and time began. But, and then in verse 8, where it's obedient to the point of death, of course, that includes not just his physical dying, but his suffering and shedding his blood that he offered in heaven for the remission of sins and cleansed the souls of the sinners. And so there's more to it than just him dying a physical death, which is for his death and obedience there.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the purpose of it was what was significant about his coming to die. Yes? Yes.
So a good translation there, you know, verse 7, is he emptied himself. Or in some cases, he emptied himself empty, which is kind of a weird sound. But as you made allusion to it, it means that he laid aside his privilege. That's what he did there. I wanted to point out, though, I think probably one of the most important points is the one Ron made, and we need to get back to it in a while, about how do we humble ourselves. But I wanted to make clear that we talk about Jesus being humble. That is not what verse 8 is talking about.
Right.
Verse 8 is talking about him humbling himself.
Right.
That's a different thing.
Right. I don't know if I made that clear, but I did want to make that distinction. I do think that his humility in the sense of the fact that he... you know, when we talk about being humble, as we talked about earlier, the idea of being humble, it comes out of selflessness. So there's no ego involved here. And this is a sign. What he willingly suffered, what he went through, was a sign that he wasn't concerned about himself. So there's a humility that's... I mean, he was a humble individual as he's on this earth. He humbled himself to God, certainly. That didn't change the fact that he knew who he was. I'm just saying that it was a selfless activity. But the humbling of self, I think, is understood within that context of the death, the humiliation, the death, those things being done on our part. And the word humbling is an indication of an activity that was gone through, that was maybe perhaps the better description would be allowing himself to be humiliated or humbled. The only difference there is in that allowing himself, I mean, it was his will, it was his desire. He could have at any time, of course, avoided it, but he didn't desire to. No one was able to do that unless he allowed them to. But the humbling of self is abasing. Yeah, the term abase, I think that's a really good term to use there. Allowed himself to be abased or abased himself, perhaps be better. By the way, with regard to that in verse 7, but made himself with no reputation. The term is, the actual literal term would be empty, as Justin indicated. In fact, there are some translations that would use that. But and this is the key, when we talk about the emptying of himself, this is why someone says, see, it says he emptied himself, which means he emptied himself of divine characteristics. In other words, he was no longer God. And that violates other plain scriptures. That's the point. And that's the reason why the context did not indicate that. Because if that would be the case, then those passages which, I mean, the Jews, for example, sought to kill him because he called himself the Son of God, making himself equal with God. The prophecy concerning his birth, that you shall bear a child and call his name Emmanuel, which translated is God with us. the text of John chapter 1, which indicates the Word was in the beginning with God, the Word was God, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. God became flesh and dwelt among us. That's what John 1 is affirming in John 1:14. So these passages very clearly teach that Jesus was God while he was on earth. So when we talk about him emptying himself, it can't have reference to his divine nature. So it has to have reference to something else. And it is that position, or as Justin indicated, and I think it, in the center notes of the New King James Bible, it says the same. He emptied himself of those privileges he had at the right hand of the Father, coming as a man and giving those things up or divesting himself of those things, that position, that honor, that prestige, to come and live as a man on earth.
A couple things. First is, I think the discussion we've just been having could be likened to that TV show where the CEOs go down and take way, way bottom of the ladder, positions among their company just to see again what it was like when everything was at the bottom, see if they still got it or whatnot. If you're having a hard time drawing that image of what we've been talking about, then that would probably be a good thing.
In the sense they were still CEO, but they also were working
at the bottom.
Because Jesus didn't need to find out what it was like. That wasn't the point. But,
true.
In that sense. But yeah, that would be a terrible thing.
Next thing is, I've been reading this over and over just now, and it kind of blew me away when I realized, said, by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Wow. Everybody is a servant. We're here to be servants. I mean, and that's how God sees us, and rightfully so. I mean, Ecclesiastes is 13:12, I think. The whole duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. 12:13. Okay, I always get that mixed up. But then I was looking at kind of like how, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before when we were discussing taking the form of servant doesn't necessarily mean that you're an obedient servant, or even if you are obedient, that you are an humble servant. But it says being born in the likeness of men and being found in human form. I had to think about that a second. I was like, well, that seems kind of like a redundant statement. Like, the other statements seemed kind of redundant. Servant, humble, obedient, of course. Well, being born in the likeness of men. Well, how are men born? Well, he was born of woman. And then he was found in human form. He was found in the likeness of men. And I also found that interesting as I was looking at that. Right. And that's it.
Good enough. What I would like to do, we may not be able to do this, but I'd like to pretty much do a lesson a week. So I want to go to Matthew 26 and let's kind of tie that together in with it. It's a little bit, and I knew that we would spend more time in Philippians 2. We can, by the way, come back to it if need be, and certainly will by making a few applications at the end of our time together. But Matthew chapter 26, on this particular occasion, Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane. We know this to be near the end of his life. This was at the point in time he would be betrayed by Judas, which happens in verse 47. So this is the prayer that Jesus offered God in this darkest of hours. You remember that he had asked Peter and John and James to come with him deeper into the garden. And then told them to stay and watch. And he went further and fell on his face and prayed. He prayed in verse 39 of the text, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." I don't know if you remember, but I remember and I've appreciated a couple of times where Dennis has talked about what Jesus suffered on this particular occasion, how difficult it was for him. And I think that we would do a disservice to our Savior not to consider what it was that Jesus was submitting to on this occasion and in his life. He came to this earth. Those things that he had, he gave up. And this humbling himself to the point of death on the cross was an extremely difficult thing to do. So much so that in his physical duress and the stress that he was experiencing at this time, he cried out to God in prayer, "If it's possible, let this cup pass from me." So this was something to where it was a very, very difficult thing. Not an easy thing to do. We should not construe this as meaning that Jesus changed his mind and didn't want to help man. That's not the point. It's just that he acknowledged and was in agony as a result of what was going to be necessary. And so this was Jesus crying out for relief, if possible, but willing even to do this if necessary. And of course, we understand, and I think he understood, that it was necessary that he died on the cross. And that's why the "nevertheless" ends that particular verse. "Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And so what I wanted to note with regard to that is simply this selflessness, and let's tie them together, the selflessness that he expressed in his willingness to come is evidenced in his obedience. And so the obedience even to the point of death, obedience no matter the cost, obedience without limitation, was something that is a wonderful characteristic, a very difficult characteristic for us to emulate, but one that is expected of us as well. We cannot go to God with conditions. Yes, God, I'll obey you, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do the other, but you cannot expect me to give up or to do a particular thing. You hear time and time again in the religious world today that Jesus accepts you as you are, or come to our church and we'll accept you as you are. There is seldom that challenge that God requires you to change. That's what repentance is. God requires you to crucify self, to submit wholly and fully to his will. And he expects that of every single one of us. And that is, again, is something we look at and say, yeah, Jesus did that. Of course he did that. But it was not an easy thing. And yet he was willing to do so. So any comments, questions about that, or anything about that scripture that you have any question about at all? It's a little more straightforward as far as the narrative. But yes, Dick?
How we read here about how what Jesus went through in Matthew 26, 38 through 42, all that ties in with Philippians 2, 8, where he became obedient to the point of death. And according to Hebrews 5 and verse 8, he had to learn obedience. And he was obedient to everything else, but he probably even learned obedient things that he suffered. Right? And so being in heaven as the Word and Son of God, he didn't know about death and knowing about taking upon the sins of the world. He's not only God to visit with it, he's going to take upon the sins of everyone that has lived and now living and will live, even though it was despicable and abominable and horrible to him and the Father and the Holy Spirit. So he had to learn that.
Yeah, when we talk about the death of Christ, we acknowledge that others have died a martyr's death. Others have died for causes that they've held dear. But there's a difference between the death of Christ and the death of all others with regard to what that means for us and what he experienced and what happened on that occasion, because it was something if Peter died, he didn't die for me. And when Jesus died because of his sinless state, because of him being both God and man, all of those things combined made him a sacrifice for us, the Passover lamb that was slain. And that is significant. It's something that, of course, that's what the whole concept of redemption is tied up in, is that death.
I'm tempted to think when Jesus said, "Let this cup pass from me," that possibly he was talking about something else, maybe the suffering he was going through, in the garden. Because after it was over, we're told the angels came and strengthened him, and when the crowd came and Judas came, it was a different person. You know, he stood up against them. They all fell back, what he was saying, but that's not the case. That's not what he was talking about. Matthew 20, when the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus and said, would you put one son on the left and one on the right? He said to them, when he was speaking to James and John, he said, you do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? He's talking about the death of crucifixion. And the phenomenal thing about this to me is, somewhere between his birth and the age of 12, he became self-aware. Not just being a boy, not just being a human, but being God in the flesh. Don't know if he heard a call like Samuel did, you know, as a boy. I'd love to learn someday how this happened. But somewhere in there, he became self-aware to the point that he knew what his mission in life was. Even before he went to Jerusalem, before he talked before the elders there. So when he says this in Matthew 20, and during his 3 years, not only did he know what the plan was, he knew exactly what it was going to entail. You know, thousands of people have been crucified. A lot of people have witnessed the suffering. But no one knows what it's like to go through it. Jesus knew what it was going to be like to the details. And for him, who had a part in the planning of our salvation for thousands of years before this event, for him in the garden to beg his father to not require him to do this, just phenomenal. Because he knows in his spiritual heart that if the heart of the Savior, the world cannot be saved unless he does it. And he knows there's no other way. He's had this discussion over and over, you know, with his father, even during his life on earth. And yet for him to do that, it really drives home to me the suffering that he was going through.
The suffering, and as such, it drives home his humanity.
The mental torture.
Yeah.
It was more than just physical. It
drives home he is a man.
Absolutely.
Very good. Yes, Jessica.
So, the point of this lesson is that that's what's required of us.
Right.
Right? So, in our subservience, in our focus on others, ultimately, in our focus on God the Father, and in our goal to be obedient to Him, we are called to self-humble, and we are called to self-sacrifice. And if need be, we're called to sacrifice whatever. Our lives, the lives of others, whatever. And that's heavy stuff. So you told us to come up with, you know, how do you pull it out? That was one of your two things.
Right.
How did you obtain it? And then what do you do with it once you got it? How do you obtain it? Well, you can go through what you think. You think about it, you meditate, you study. You find mentors. You find people that are closer to it than you are. But really, you got to start doing it. Until you start doing it and realizing where you're short and realizing what you got to do next. I mean, it's like when I used to tutor people taking the ACT. I mean, I could teach it fast. But knowing stuff and knowing how to take a test aren't the same thing. And so once you get out there and do it, you realize, oh, well, here's a whole aspect where I'm not meeting up to that ultimate stake that Christ made.
Good.
But if you get there, but you won't. But the closer you get to there, what do you do with it? Everything.
Yeah, this is one of those that's going to have a real wide application. Because when we're talking about submission to God's will, that's just it. We must submit to Him in everything. And that's the key. And what I wanted to bring up in that mind is that the rich young ruler who kept all of the commands from his youth up, and Jesus said, one thing that you lack. And there was one thing that he had kept back from God, and that's the thing that had to be given up. And it's not going to be riches for all of us. It may be something else for us. We have to figure out the one thing that is most difficult for us to give to the Lord, to say, I submit to your will in this, and make sure that that's the thing that we give up. It's not a matter of going to God and say, God, I'll give you this, 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 and this, and maybe later on... I'll give you the others, but right now I'm going to hold it back. We can't do that and expect to be acceptable to God. We have to give that up, whatever that is, and it's going to be something you need to identify for yourself. So as far as applying that, that's a good point to be made. As he indicated, I had the idea of says watch some way to develop humility, study, thinking of others, prayer, but that contemplation, in other words, just actually thinking about the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. In other words, if he didn't hold back something of himself, if he didn't say no, then we certainly don't have the right to. His selflessness serves as that wonderful example for us. And one of the best ways that we can, you know, you hear about people being shamed. I saw someone else doing that, and I kind of got ashamed of myself. Because if they could do it, surely I could do it. That's kind of the idea that we ought to have. Jesus was God. If God was willing to humble himself in coming to earth and suffering the indignities of the cross, divesting himself of that privilege, then who am I to refuse to do that before God? And understanding your place is something that's very helpful in regard to it. And then ways to express it. This is the other thing in everything, but specifically in the context of Philippians 2, compromising with others, looking out for others' self-interest rather than your own self-interest. So deference. And then, of course, submitting to the will of God. Anything, and we're almost out of time, but I want me and Justin to be the only ones that make those applications. Anybody want to add anything to the things that you can do to get it, the selflessness and humility and the submission to the will, or any ways which you can express it if you want to add to what we've already talked about? All right. No. That means we finished an entire lesson in one sitting. That's good. And, you know, these kinds of things, we'll have a couple of verses for each. We're not going to be doing that every single week, but I would like to keep it on a fairly good pace. So, again, I would encourage you to read the verses before. Spend a little time. If you've got any questions about the verses themselves, write those questions down, or maybe come to the conclusion yourself and share it with the class. Focus on that specific characteristic that we're discussing. Make sure that you have a biblical concept of what that characteristic is, and then ask yourself two questions. How can we attain it, and what can we do with it? We get those two things, and we cover that with all these characteristics. I think we do very well in making application of these passages. Thank you very much for your kind attention tonight.